This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The General Accounting Office is now predicting that the savings and loan bailout will cost the U.S. government $500 billion. This is one of the most important domestic crises and one of the most difficult to comprehend. An article in the September issue of Harper's Magazine has many people saying, "Now I understand what happened." The article, called Chronicle of a Debacle Foretold, by writer L.J. Davis, traces the S&L crisis from its roots to what Davis calls the most astounding financial scandal the nation has ever witnessed. We've invited L.J. Davis on the show to help unravel the complications of the current crisis. Davis is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. His 1987 article, which predicted the stock market crash, won a National Magazine Award. Davis says savings and loan institutions were first created in the U.S. in 1831 with one simple purpose.
They were established to allow thrifty artisans to own their own homes. And the first thrifts, in fact, were simply associations of these thrifty artisans, banded together and deposited sums of money in a central place. And as each person built his home, he withdrew from the system, and when the last person built their home, the fund was closed down. It was called an ideal 3-6-3 business. You paid 3% for your deposits, you lent the money back out at 6%, and you hit the golf course at 3% if you were an S&L executive. The purpose was still to build homes for the American laboring classes and middle classes. In other words, a social purpose. Didn't make a heck of a lot of money, but it also didn't take a whole lot of brains to run. And until the Reagan administration, most of the S&Ls in the country were what were called mutual associations. That is, they were still owned by their depositors. And they were amongst the soundest financial institutions in the known universe. Not one mutual association failed during the Great Depression, for example.
Now, you said that by the end of the 1970s, S&Ls weren't doing very well. Why not?
Well, if you just look at the economics of the situation, an S&L is going to be literally as sound as a dollar. But an S&L is going to depend on stable interest rates because of what it does. It loans out money in the form of home mortgages. Now, mortgages are what are called in the trade slow assets. A mortgage can last for as long as 30 years. So as long as your interest rates are stable, of course, you can charge the 6% on that 30-year mortgage and see a handsome return, a comfortable return, never a handsome return. If something happens to interest rates, however, if they shoot into the stratosphere, you as an S&L executive are going to find yourself getting killed. And that's precisely what happened in the 1970s. The sequence of events is fairly easy to follow now in retrospect. Everybody thinks the U.S. went off the gold standard in 1936. As a matter of fact, it didn't go off the gold standard until 1971, when President Nixon decided that we weren't going to settle our international accounts in gold and, in effect, declared the nation insolvent. What does this mean? This means that the dollar is now floating around. It's no longer tied to a store of value, and it becomes a highly mobile instrument. Simultaneously, you've got a persistent, intractable inflation going on that was introduced by Lyndon Johnson when he tried to fight a land war in Asia while stoking a boom at home through the simple expedient of printing a lot more money. And inflation occurs in the simplest sense when things get more expensive and you print more money to try to pay the bill. Then in 1972-3, the Arabs saw their opportunities and they took them. Blew the price of oil into the stratosphere, causing everything in the world to briefly become vastly more expensive, and because we printed more money to try to pay the bill, causing the persistent intractable inflation to escalate until you got double digits by the end of the decade. Well, fine, you're an S&L executive and you're getting your 6% return, but you need your depositor base or else you're going to go out of business. And your depositors see that money markets, which are uninsured, are offering money market rates, 13, 14, 15% for your money. So you have a sudden exodus, what looks like a disastrous, catastrophic exodus of money from the S&Ls into money market funds as people try, intelligently, to deploy their savings to counter the to take advantage of and also to counter the inflationary pressures. And so the SNLs, around 1980, look like they're going broke.
Why did Congress start to deregulate the SNLs?
Well, you know, deregulation was in the air ever since early 1970s report that was commissioned by President Nixon. Deregulation, in some cases, looked really good. But as with everything in Washington, what starts off as a good idea became first a fad and then a frenzy. And especially with the arrival of the Reagan administration and its determination to get government off the backs of the American people and out of the pocket of the American businessman. They not merely wanted to deregulate everything. They wished the government to go away entirely, including the government as represented by the oversight of America's financial institutions.
Congress started to deregulate the SNLs in the late 70s. You say they went about it backwards. How did they go about it backwards?
Well, if you are going to deregulate a savings and loan institution, what you should do, one thing, actually, they should have done precisely nothing and wait for the business cycle to turn, which would cause the deposits to flow back into the SNLs, as happened anyway. But if you're going to deregulate these things, what you do first is you allow them to adjust their income stream, where they make their money, and where they make their money is in their mortgage portfolio. So you allow them to have something that they have long wanted, which is something called an adjustable rate mortgage. That is, the SNL can adjust the rate of its mortgages to reflect the economic realities of the greater society. Then, after a period of time has elapsed, and this can be a couple of years or maybe even a little bit longer, you then allow them to deregulate the interest they pay to their depositors. You bring that back up to free market. If you don't do it that way, if you do it the way that they actually did do it, a bank is going to be literally shoveling money out of its door. What they did was, because many people in America regarded as cheap mortgages as a God-given right, they left mortgage rates right where they were, but they allowed the banks to pay any kind of interest for deposits that they wanted to. Desperate for funds, of course, the banks jacked their rates up to compete with money market interest rates. And so what you had was banks that were paying 13 and 14% to their depositors and only receiving 6 to 9% on their mortgages, which is, A, did it backwards, and B, it had the result I just described, as anybody who can figure with a stub of a pencil on the back of an envelope can see. You're shoveling money out the door.
In 1980, Congress raised the insurance of an SNL account from $40,000 to $100,000. In other words, if you had $40,000 in an SNL account, that would have been insured. But after 1980, you could have had as much as $100,000, and it would be insured by the federal government. There was no hearing. There was no debate about raising the amount that was insured by the federal government. What was the rationale for raising it from $40,000 to $100,000?
Well, the ostensible rationale was to catch up with inflation. Now, let's do a little thing here on what deposit insurance is for. When Franklin Roosevelt decided to regulate the SNLs, he was intensely suspicious of deposit insurance. That is, that the government would stand behind the SNL and guarantee that if somebody kept his deposit below a certain threshold, that person would never lose any money if the SNL failed. President Roosevelt was intensely suspicious of this because he didn't want the SNL executives making bets on the public nickel, that is, taking those deposits, federally insured, and going out with the wild sense of abandon that comes with knowing that you are throwing away money you simply cannot lose because it's guaranteed by the federal government. So deposit insurance was historically kept rather low. It had ratcheted up, as you say, to about $40,000 in 1980. But the actual rationale for this ratcheting up to $100,000 for each deposit was to allow the banks, the SNLs, to attract large amounts of capital. In fact, at this level, an SNL could attract a virtually unlimited amount of capital. The country's awash in money, despite its somewhat parlous economic condition, because of all the petrodollars that are floating around in the system. And a lot of this money is looking for a home. Now, it's in the hands of institutions, pension funds, endowment funds, insurance companies, investment banks, stock brokerages, and so on. Now, you got a lot of surplus cash lying around these places, and you're looking for a place to put it. If an SNL could pay a handsome rate of interest, of course, that would attract the attention of all these custodians of the surplus cash. And it was especially attractive because it made your task a lot easier with the federal $100,000 cap on insurance. You could put your money in somewhat larger packages, deposit it in a savings and loan, receive a handsome rate of interest, and know that this money was absolutely safe. It's a no-brainer bet, because the American taxpayer is going to have to pay it back if the SNL goes out of business.
Let's get back to FDR. And you said that he was suspicious of federal insurance of SNL accounts because he felt that this could lead to a certain irresponsibility on the part of bankers. They could do anything and think, well, heck, I mean, the money's insured. The feds will take care of it. So what Roosevelt did was put a lot of regulations into effect to ensure the responsibility of the bankers. Now, what we have when the insurance is raised from $40,000 to $100,000, we simultaneously have deregulation going on. So it's kind of exactly the opposite of what Roosevelt had in mind.
Absolutely. This whole catastrophe occurred because of a very simple thing. If you give criminals an opportunity to steal money, they'll do it. Look, you raise the ante by insuring the money up to $100,000, and then you say anybody can own an SNL, provided he looks like he's got enough money to buy it. You're going to have and you also say that you're going to cut the examination force, and you're reducing all sorts of regulations, and you're cutting down the amount of capital he has to have on hand. And in states like California, which has a state-chartered savings and loan system, distinct from the federal system, but still federally insured, a piece of legislation called the Nolan Act was passed that said that an owner of an SNL could invest the deposits in his custody in anything he could think of. He could buy Antarctic real estate, mushroom farms. There was one SNL in California that was particularly fond of things that had to do with manure. Reprocessing plants, power from manure. It also bought subsidized a lot of windmill farms. All this money's lost, of course. That was simply foolish. In the cases that we see arising in California, Texas, Florida, perhaps even in Colorado, where the president's son is involved, what we witness instead is outright criminality. People taking advantage of the liberal state laws. These things mostly happen at state-chartered, not federally chartered, chartered associations, to make all sorts of lunatic loans. Now, I happen to have gotten hold of the examination reports from Lincoln SNL, the one that Charles H. Keating got hold of in Southern California. And a child wouldn't have made these loans. These loans are range from the ludicrous to the outright fraudulent. You had people being loaned their own down payment. You had people being loaned enough money to make to keep the payments current for 2 years, whereupon the loan could be refinanced. You had the loans being made without paperwork, without applications, without credit checks, without appraisals of the collateral, without any collateral whatever. You had down payments being channeled through third parties. Why would anybody do something like this? This is giving away the bank's money.
Yeah, why would they do it?
Well, every time you make a loan, you post it on your book as a profitable loan, because at first it seems to be. You've charged points. Anybody who's ever gone to a bank and tried to do this knows exactly what they have to do. There are origination fees. There are all sorts of other kinds of fees. And this produces a profit on the bank's book. The loan can be absolutely insane, and many of them were.
So this is to make yourself look like you're making a profit on paper.
That's right, because if you're making a profit on paper, you can either pay yourself handsome dividends, or another thing you can do if you've got this immensely profitable-looking association is you can pay yourself a gigantic salary. If you're intimately involved with the affairs of the association the way an entrepreneur named Don Ray Dixon was in Dallas at his SNL, Vernon, you can have the bank pay for your wedding. You can have the association pay to fly you to Europe to examine the great cafes of France, because you're planning to open a cafe in Dallas. You can have it pay for your houses and so on. You can have this happen in part because the administration, the Reagan administration in Washington, refuses to pay any attention to what you're doing. Except that when what you're doing is called to the attention of, say, Secretary of the Treasury Donald Regan, who thought this was a terrific idea, when you point out to him that savings and loan entrepreneurs are suddenly sporting giant pinky rings, driving around in blue Rolls Royces, building marble-clad, gold-plated towers and occupying huge mansions, Secretary Regan took it as proof positive that the Reagan plan was working, that he had unleashed the entrepreneurial energies of a lot of people. In place of that, of course, we were being robbed blind.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is L.J. Davis, and he's chronicled the SNL crisis in an article in the September issue of Harper's Magazine. And Davis is a contributing editor to Harper's. This is Fresh Air. L.J. Davis is my guest, and we're talking about the SNL crisis. Looking back on the SNL crisis, who do you think are the main culprits in causing the crisis?
Well, this is a wonderful bipartisan crisis as far as the culprits are concerned. The principal culprit, of course, is the Reagan administration, with their lunatic belief in any kind of deregulation, which led them to deregulate financial institutions that were making huge bets with federally insured money, which is by itself insane. So the principal villains here, I would say, would be Secretary of the Treasury and later Chief of Staff Donald Regan. He recently went before the House Banking Committee and made the astonishing statement that the problem was caused by not enough deregulation not too much of it. You'd think, of course, that the democratically controlled Congress might give us some oversight and might actually make some political hay off the problems that are now suddenly occurring as a result of deregulation in the SNLs. But no such thing happened. We've often wondered how much the United States Congress is worth, and now I think we can put a dollar figure to it. The SNL barons were able to buy the services of the United States Congress for $11 million.
Now, what are you referring to?
That's how much they made in campaign contributions to a broad spectrum of congressmen and senators on both sides of the aisles. And the docility that they purchased throughout the early period of this crisis, in fact, up until 1988, is literally astonishing. Such unlikely heroes of this affair as Ronald Reagan's own chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, Ed Gray, attempted time after time after time to warn the Congress about what was happening. He explained it until he was blue in the face. He's like the ancient mariner now, who stoppeth one in three, trying to explain what happened. He gives out copies of speeches he gave in 1983, 84, trying to alert the Congress. But the Congress was utterly inert, amazingly enough.
And you're saying this is because people in Congress got up to $11 million total from SNLs in campaign contributions.
Yes, well, this may seem like a fairly bold statement, but it is a miracle on the order of the loaves and the fishes for any constituent to get two senators, much less five senators, in a room lobbying on his behalf. And yet that is precisely what happened with the so-called Keating Five. Senators Cranston, DeConcini, McCain, Glenn, and Riegler. Lobbying intensely for an SNL baron in Southern California, Charles H. Keating, whose failed Lincoln savings and loan is probably going to cost us more than $2 billion, trying to, in effect, get the examination of this of Lincoln called off. As it happened, the examiners were fighting to their horror that Lincoln was a wide-open bucket shop, and we're recommending that be shut down at once. Nonetheless, Charles H. Keating, who was generous in his campaign contributions to all five of these senators, and who had hired Senator Glenn's former administrative assistant, made him a vice president of his company. Anyway, Charles Keating was able to get the five senators in a room, and they were real tough.
What's your assessment of President Bush's bailout plan?
President Bush's bailout plan is, to put a word to it, fraudulent. The actual cost of closing the SNLs that we know are amongst the living dead is going to be minimum $200 million. Yet the General Accounting Office says that this thing is going to cost us $500 billion minimum before we finally get out of this. Where are the discrepancy? Well, the fact of the matter is that both Congress and the President are desperate to keep the SNL crisis off the budget. So they're not paying for it directly with taxpayer money. Indirectly, they are. In place of that, they're selling bonds. This is what's called an off-budget item. Whenever you sell a bond, you've got to pay interest to the bondholder. So for every dollar that you and I and the American taxpayer spend to close down one of these lunatic SNLs, we're going to have to pay $1.50 in interest. And meanwhile, they're pretending that it's not part of the budget deficit because they're keeping it over here in the Resolution Trust Corporation and selling the bonds.
Did you say for every dollar we have to pay $1.50 in interest?
That's right.
We're paying 150% in interest?
That's how much it's going to be over the 40-year life of the bonds.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
And furthermore, bear in mind that that's a minimum figure. The $500 billion, the half-trillion bucks in both closure expenses and interest is what we can count right now. A lot of these associations were running wide open with no paperwork. So what the examiners are doing right now is trying to find out where else all the rest of the money went. And this is really hard to do if nobody wrote anything down. That figure is sure to get larger.
What's the next thing you're looking at in the SNL crisis? What's the next big issue or big trial on the horizon?
Let me think. Well, the ongoing circus at Silverado Savings and Loan involving the president's son, Neil Bush, is certainly a lot of fun. By and large, most of this is over now. Now we got to pay the bill. What we're going to end up with is not much of a savings and loan system left in the country, and therefore the noble social purpose of providing inexpensive mortgages to thrifty artisans may go by the boards. This crisis, however, is over. It's been shut down. And now it just costs us an awful lot of money. It's not the only thing that's going to cost us an awful lot of money, because our friends in Washington are also trying to balance the books by looting the Social Security system, but that's another story.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks a lot.
And L.J. Davis is the author of an article on the SNL crisis that was published in the September issue of Harper's Magazine, where he's a contributing editor. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.